From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your shit bare.
Adele is just one of the many major stars in recent months who've gone under the knife for throat surgery. So have John Mayer and R. Kelly. Keith Urban is scheduled for a surgery later this month. What's behind this uptick? Are today's biggest singers doing something different with their voices? This hour, On Point, singing stars and vocal surgery. And you can join the conversation. What do you think? Could modern singers be using their voices in a way that puts them under more strain? Or are they just taking advantage of new medical techniques that haven't always been available? Joining me first from Los Angeles is Shirley Halperin. She's music editor for The Hollywood Reporter. She wrote a piece called Why Are So Many Singers Having Surgery? Shirley Halperin, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
And thank you for providing me with the first question. Why are so many singers having surgery?
Well, I think the main reason is because they're putting so much more strain on their voice, and that's a scheduling thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I think is more of a recent phenomenon is just the fact that singers, musicians, artists, actors, they just don't turn themselves off between Facebook and web chats and the fact that they're tweeting all night and they have concerts and they're recording very late into the night. Their entire world is work, and they don't get the chance to properly rest, not their body, not their voice, not their peace of mind.
Is this a function of the breakdown of the music industry? You used to just be able to lay down a couple tracks and a couple recording sessions, sell your music, make your money, and now you have to do all this hustling you're alluding to.
I don't know if it's so much a breakdown as it is an acceleration. There used to be an album cycle where you would put out an album, you would tour it for 2 years, you'd take a year off on hiatus, and then you'd put out another album. Now, I mean, look at someone like Drake. You know, there's a mixtape every few months. There's an album every year. Sometimes there's two albums in a year if you look at Justin Bieber. I mean, you know, it just never stops.
Yeah, and for all, to take someone like Bieber, I mean, we've heard so much, especially like me, if you've got Bieber fever, we've heard so much about all the time that goes into, you know, his training and his musicality and all the lessons. I haven't heard too much about what he does to keep his voice healthy, and I wonder if that's kind of the last thing on the repertoire of how to be and maintain stardom.
Well, Mike, clearly you have not seen the Justin Bieber Never Say Never movie, because...
Was that the one in 3D? That frightened me.
It was in 3D, and that was a big part of the movie, was how is he maintaining his voice, because not only does he put a lot of strain on his voice and is he singing constantly, but his voice is changing. He's, you know, entering puberty, and hormones affect a voice. All these things play a factor, and in the movie, it showed him working tirelessly with a vocal coach to save his voice so that he could perform this very big show at Madison Square Garden and not have to cancel. You know, we hear about cancellations all the time.
Right.
Remember, it used to be exhaustion?
Yeah.
Well, now it literally is exhaustion. It's vocal exhaustion.
Right. They cried wolf with that. It usually meant exhaustion having to do with, you know, a three-day bender. But what are the feelings within the music community? Are they grappling with this? Are they frightened about the injuries? Are they sort of pleased that the surgery exists, like, you know, aging actresses who are really quite happy about Botox?
I mean, I think record companies like Adele's record company, Columbia, are incredibly concerned about her health because she's so young. She's only 21, and to be having, you know, vocal problems this early in her career and in her life is definitely a serious concern. But there has been a lot of progress made on the surgery front, which I'm sure you'll hear about this hour, that I think makes it easier for artists to go through this procedure and not postpone it. One thing that came up in my interviews is I spoke to Paul Stanley from Kiss, who said that for 40 years he avoided dealing with problems with his throat, with his vocal cords, and he's screaming for 40 years as a rock star. So I think if anything, singers are now aware of the problem, and they can get in to fix it very quickly. It can be remedied rather than something that they suffer through for decades.
Paul Stanley's bandmate Gene Simmons did pioneer some of the tongue exercises, I think, that rehabilitate the throat. I might be making that up there. Shirley Halperin, thank you very much, Shirley.
Thank you.
Charlie's the music editor for The Hollywood Reporter, and she brings us to our next guest quite nicely. Dr. Steven Zeitels is the director of the Center for Laryngeal Surgery. Did I get that right?
That's good.
The first part of laryngeal surgery is saying laryngeal surgery and voice rehabilitation at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's a professor of laryngeal surgery at Harvard Medical School, and he's been in the headlines recently for performing surgery on the vocal cords of the Grammy-winning singer Adele. He has also operated on Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, Roger Daltrey of The Who, Julie Andrews, and opera singer Denise Graves. Dr. Zeitels, thank you for joining us.
Hi there.
Have voices gotten more damaged, or is it the case, like they said in the $6 Million Man, we can rebuild it, we have the technology?
I think there's a wide spectrum of issues here. I think there have been substantial injuries for decades. I think one of the scenarios is that voice care, voice science is better distributed throughout the world, let alone the United States. There are voice centers in almost every city. So there's great available imaging and diagnostic technology and people who know how to use it. So I think there's an awareness both in the industry as well amongst the caregivers that you need to be checked, not just ride it out. Mm-hmm. So I do believe, as your former guest indicated, that there are a lot more vocal responsibilities that are for anybody in today's society, and that is coupling to what is demanded of them. But I think it's sort of clear if you took a pop or a rock world, when I was younger, the concerts were a lot longer.
Right.
So in fact, if you just said the intensity of any individual performance, I remember being a teenager and it was not unusual to be at 4 or 5 hour concerts. So there is actually less performance in that regard. However, the amount of communications that are happening all day long are accelerated in a way today because of the constant interaction on the internet.
Right. And I also think there might be a media component to sell if you're going to be performing at the local concert hall. It used to be you could go on one huge megawatt radio show and do your promotion that way in one newspaper. Now, performers have to sell themselves. And oftentimes there's a performance, a little bit of singing on the radio show that you go on to. So maybe if you added up the number of minutes sung by a performer today versus the time of Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, or Betty Carter, maybe they actually are singing more today, even if their concerts aren't as long.
Well, we did an interesting experiment with Steve a number of years ago.
Steve Tyler.
My colleague Bob Hillman and our voice scientists built a vocal accumulator, and we actually have only placed this on two professionals, it's Steve Tyler and Dick Vitale, the basketball announcer. And what this did was pick up the number of vibrations in the skin and actually get data as to what occurred. And this was kind of staggering. Stephen probably sang in that particular show roughly 70 minutes of singing, because clearly there is instrumentals and things. And in that one show, he collided his vocal cords 780,000 times, and he was maintaining 105 decibels most of that time. So that's intensity. But then there are all the normal obligations all day. So the reason this vocal accumulator was designed is to capture the information that you talked about, not only what happens in a show, what happens when a person wakes up in the morning and just goes all day. And it had to be done in such a way that you didn't record the voice because there would be no privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So all this did was pick up the vibrations without being able to hear what they were really saying.
Right. And apart from being a good way to narc out a monk, it seems like this, what's it called? It sounds like a pedometer.
It was a vocal accumulator, if you will.
Vocal accumulator. Did it reveal that Steven Tyler was stressing his vocal cords as much in the 22 hours a day he wasn't on stage?
No, we only recorded him on stage. Okay. We didn't have it on, but its capability was, because realistically, when someone comes to your office, you're gathering that information about their voice use based on talking to them, asking them questions.
Mm-hmm.
This would be it would be similar to a Holter monitor for the heart, so that we would have true data as to what occurred all day. We wouldn't just be asking them a few questions and making a judgment about their personality.
You think that device will become commonplace?
As time goes on, yes, for a very important reason. I think we're hitting a period that we're going to see more and more trauma to vocal cords. Our technical word for that, it's not too unusual, it's phonotrauma, just like a phonograph. And what's happening here is the fastest way for a human being to move information is to think it and say it. Interestingly, most people who are active in Western society, their vocal downtime is when they're manually inputting on a keyboard. And for the advantage of portability, it's even slower with two thumbs on a portable device.
Right. And it's, as we as a society move out of the fields and into the office, and then as we move from the office into always having a phone on our ear and in our mouth, we're just talking more and more and more.
But voice recognition, what did Apple come out with? Pretty soon we're not going to be thumbing in the information, and it's going to accelerate things even further. And so what we have here is a scenario where communications are accelerating. These performers have, you know, intense commitments, but they are needing to use their voice all day.
Never mind.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the spate of vocal surgeries for star singers, from Adele to R. Kelly. We're joined this hour by Dr. Steven Zeitels. He's the director of the Voice Center at Mass General Hospital. He recently performed surgery on the vocal cords of multi-Grammy-winning singer Adele. Also joining us in our studio is Penelope Bitzes. She's a professor of music at Boston University and an accomplished mezzo-soprano. Penelope, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm well. And my question for you is, I think there's this inclination to say, oh, back in the old days, the singers didn't have these problems. Hefe 68 writes in, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, and Betty Carter never had throat surgery. Were they somehow stronger, better trained, or is, in fact, our recollection inaccurate?
I think it's a little bit of wrong history in it, because I think people had those same problems before, but the frequency of performances were less. Travel took a lot longer than it does today, so people had rest just because the way they got around was slower. So I think it existed, but it was not known about. And now we know about everything, so we hear about everything more often, so we're more aware of it. So I think it probably happened then, but I think it was not as much as today, and we hear about it a lot less.
Do you train your singers? How much of your training in terms of hitting the notes and reaching those, but how much is just maintaining your vocal health?
Well, I mostly teach classical singers, but when I taught non-classical singers, it was a lot about vocal health. And even with these kids, it's vocal health because they're, as you say, really busy. They do use their voices more all day long. So it's a lot of, like, how do you keep it healthy? What's your daily routine to keep your mechanism really working in an efficient and healthy manner?
And I think you point the blame, but also give the credit to Ethel Merman a little bit in all of this.
Well, in terms of musical theater, she was the big shift in the sound for musical theater sound. And she had a one in a million voice that was an incredible natural belt voice that really worked for her.
Let's hear Ethel Merman.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow.
Penelope, can you tell us what Ethel Merman is doing there with her voice to get that sound?
Well, first, I think it's her sound.
Yes.
But I also think it's just a really good high belt mix. And she was really capable of doing that fairly effortlessly.
And did other singers either try to emulate or were pushed to emulate that to their damage?
I don't want to say pushed to emulate that far, but I think she set a new standard in musical theater for that kind of a high belt sound, which is where it really what the standard is now for kids who sing that kind of music. And I think some voices can really take that and some really can't.
And if a voice can't, that's not to say they're not a good voice and they can't have success playing different roles or playing the same role in a different way.
No, not at all. I think it's just the pressure of doing that high belt can really just wreak a lot of damage on a lot of singers.
Let's talk about what the – we've been talking about injuries, Dr. Zeitel's, and I think Adele had or it was reported that she had vocal hemorrhaging. Sometimes we hear about nodules or polyps. What are polyps or what are nodules? How do they develop? How do they affect the voice?
Sure. So we'll take these things separately.
Yeah.
If you bleed, that's fairly straightforward. These are not major bleeds where you taste the blood. There are small vessels within a vocal fold that under the collision forces and shearing stresses that I just described with someone like Steven, what will happen is these tiny vessels will rupture and the singer will know it immediately because fluid, blood, will go into one vocal fold and they won't be balanced. So they will feel that they can't produce sound and it will come out very disordered. Our term for that is perturbated. And it's a rough, buzzy sound, and they know something instantly went wrong.
And is that because singers are so attuned to this? Would a regular person know it too?
Yes. When that blood goes quickly, everyone will hear it, and they will certainly feel it.
And they rush to a doctor.
No, they usually try to finish the show if they can. And in fact,
honey in the tea and all that. Yeah.
We're pretty sure. I mean, I've seen some very hardcore metal singers that, in fact, don't stop. They use that rough sound from the blood to the point where the vocal membranes will actually rupture.
Yeah.
And they get very funny scarring situations called mucosal bridges. Now, if you constantly are doing this on a tour and not recovering, you're having the collision trauma, which is a little more orderly, would be a vocal nodule. We will just call that a fibrovascular mass. It's from ongoing trauma. You don't need to be a singer to have that. People call them teacher's nodes, cheerleader's nodes. And essentially, there's a small area of scar in the center of the vocal cord. When, in fact, all of a sudden there's a chaotic bleed in one of those, then a polyp may form. And that's more of a one-sided event.
Okay, so a node leads to a polyp.
It can, but you could also just get a polyp and not get nodes.
Okay.
There's a certain amount of what we refer to as just chaos in how the trauma ensues. And those are three forms of trauma that can be separate and individual or coalesce together.
And is the solution to just simply lance the node, take it off, and then give it time to heal and you're fine?
I wouldn't say it's a simple prospect.
I shouldn't say simple.
Right? Because that is one of the problems where voice surgery really people became scared of, because just taking them off led to more scarring. And in those situations, the voice became worse. There is very delicate microsurgical techniques that are done. The laser technology that we developed at the Mass General with a gentleman named Rox Anderson was to take specialized lasers that were meant for vascular malformations in infant skin and then convert that to a laser that could be used for vocal folds, because in both scenarios, pliability, a baby's skin or a vocal fold, is paramount. Then there were a whole range of other instruments that we use under a microscope to delicately tease out the scar and leave the layer that's necessary to vibrate.
Okay, there are a number of callers on the line who've had vocal problems. Among them, Alan from Burlington, Vermont. Hello, Alan. Please present your question in the form of an aria. No, you could just say it. Go ahead, Alan.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
How are you? And your other guests are wonderful. I performed on Broadway for about 5 years. And was under the care of a wonderful doctor named Dr. Gould, who serviced me and several other Broadway performers, and never suggested the operation for the very reasons that your guest was discussing. The one thing that I learned throughout my career on Broadway, and I didn't learn it until I got to Broadway, was that I was using my voice wrong.
Uh-huh. Well, what kind of singing had you been doing up until then?
I toured with a rock band in Canada from the early 60s on. And it was in the days before monitor systems. It was in the days where you just sang into the mic and made yourself heard above the loud guitars that were pounding behind you and the drums and whatnot. And it was pretty raw, pretty brutal, pretty great, you know. And the one thing that isn't being talked about, and I noticed it with someone like Adele.
Yeah.
And I might be wandering a bit, but I think it's important, is there's an emotion that's sung with
right
a lot of the time if you're performing well. and you're not thinking about supporting your voice with your diaphragm, and you're not thinking about the exercises, and you're not thinking about the Alexander method. You're just thinking about the emotion of the song.
Right.
And when that happens, you have no control over it. And I think that someone like Adele probably got herself into that situation where it damaged her, and she has to be repaired.
But you're saying that on Broadway you learned how to do that. You learned how to sing properly.
Yeah, I learned how to sing properly, and I was, I mean, we did 8 shows a week.
Right.
I mean, they still do 8 shows a week.
Right. I got it.
I mean, I was in hair for 2.5 years, and those songs were tough.
I know it. Well, thank you for letting the sunshine in, and thank you for calling us, Alan. And Penelope Beatsis, I think what he's saying parallels what happened to Julie Andrews, who was a great singer her whole life, and Dr. Steven Zeitel. She was a patient of yours. But until she got to Broadway and she had to sing 7 days a week, that's when the rubber met the road, so to speak. What about Broadway singing either teaches you to do it the right way or exposes if you have been doing it the wrong way?
Well, I think that schedule is tough on Broadway singers, and a lot of them do have vocal surgeries to recover from misuse and just the ongoing singing. But they have to sing in that really high-pressured belt, and that can really wreak havoc sometimes on the chords. A lot of, like I said earlier, a lot of people can really handle it, and there are a lot of special voice techniques that people study that seem to work really well with Broadway singers. But I think what the caller says about the emotional aspect is really important, especially with the pop singers. It's really visceral and earthy singing.
Yeah.
And they're really singing their own words and songs to really connect with the audience. And they just let all the thing about how they have to sing well kind of go to hell in a handbasket.
Well, but don't you have to be a trained performer? I mean, actors are supposed to lose themselves in the moment, and they say they do, but they don't forget how to project. They don't forget how to cheat to the audience, and an opera singer is both an actor and a singer. So it's not like it's something that can be learned and needs to be learned to be both very emotional and yet using the proper form, right?
I completely agree with you.
Let's found a school. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting dilemmas here is that one might say that great singing, regardless of style, is the ability to transmit emotion and move an audience.
Right.
And one of the difficulties come when there is mechanical failure of vocal folds and the fear of a bleed that can completely affect a performance. The actual concern that it may occur is like you're trying to sing with emotion. It's sort of like Russian roulette. So one of the reasons to actually write a set of vocal folds through microsurgery when they're having constant trouble is there is an effect on performance. You can't possibly, if you know you're having trouble getting through the show, if you know you've had a history of hemorrhages and there's a certain amount of ambiguity as to when it may occur, that impairs people to the point where the fear of surgery is offset by the fact that they're not delivering to their audience. And I think to the callers, what he mentioned before, I knew Dr. Gould not real well, but we were colleagues. The state of the surgery then wasn't close to what it is today. So the procedures in that era were in a relative sense, I wouldn't say primitive, but they were not even close to the things that can be done today and the types of technology. So what you have here, like sports medicine, is major advancements that have been distributed so that they can be widely benefited for the patients.
And you say sports medicine, and maybe I'm a sports reporter, maybe I think in sports analogies, but it just couldn't be more stark. What you're saying is exactly like a pitcher who, if he tries to throw the ball through the catcher's mitt pitch after pitch, he's not pitching within himself and he will hurt himself. So that's like the singer says, I'm just going to sing with so much emotion, I'm going to let it all hang out. You still have to adhere to the proper form in your training, and then it actually winds up being better. And the other thing is, when you damage yourself a little bit, sometimes you can't overcompensate and you can hurt yourself even more in the long run.
Well, I think what you're referring to is that, we step back a moment. Most of the things that I operate on, and I have primarily a cancer practice, have likely been there for years.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I don't believe, similar to what Penny said, there's not an epidemic of pathology. I think you have advanced diagnostic locations and equipment, and the fear is diminishing as there are more people successfully treated. So even a cancer that has the earliest style has been preceded by dysplasia for 10 years. So nodules, polyps, these are lumps and bumps that start small, and gradually there's a tipping point where they cannot do the types of performance that's expected of their caliber, and that's when they start shifting towards a procedure.
And let's bring another voice into this conversation. Joining us from New York is Rich Juzwiak. You see, every guest right now has a Z in his name, and it tripped me up. Rich Juzwiak is a pop culture writer for The Daily. Rich, sorry about the name, but thank you for joining us.
No problem.
I'm not
no
sorry
problem.
About
it
your name. Yeah, I'm sorry about how
yeah,
I pronounced
I'm sorry about
it.
My
yeah,
name.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the bane of my existence.
So look, we have talked about performing and medical training. Let's talk about the cultural aspects. What do we demand of singers today that maybe we didn't used to?
Well, I think that the voice has returned in a big way. I think that like the early part of last decade was spent kind of unconcerned with it, and that with somebody like Adele, who sold 4 million copies in the United States, you see there's once again a premium put on the virtuoso. So there's simply a demand for that big kind of singing, whereas, you know, culturally 10 years ago, there wasn't as much.
Well, it struck me that the female singers especially, we've always liked divas and the big voice. Is that – am I wrong about that? Was there a time when that was not as in demand?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that what you saw in the early 2000s was the development of kind of the multi-threat that became – there became a premium put on that. Just generally speaking, with someone like Alicia Keys, who has a good voice but right. not, you know,
she's a great the best pianist voice. And plays instruments and so
exactly.
forth.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Someone like Usher, he was huge in the mid-2000s. And really, you know, American Idol developed. And so it was kind of like, okay, the voice is back in that respect. But all the time on that show, you hear full package, It Factor, stuff like that. On top of the fact that someone like Fantasia Barrino, who is an old school diva, mm-hmm. Would seem to have been in demand via American Idol, but her records didn't sell. Like we wanted her to win. We just didn't want to hear her after that. So I do think that with people like Adele and Susan Boyle and Josh Groban, this kind of giant voice is back, and those are the records that are selling.
Right, male and female. And another huge technological advancement, some might say detriment, auto-tune. Do you think auto-tune helps or hurts voices? Is it a crutch? And if it is a crutch, does it lead to bad habits?
Well, you know, when it's a crutch, you can't tell that it's a crutch. The thing about autotune is that it's so explicit, or at least it was maybe kind of tapering out last year. So I don't know. I mean, I would love to hear what Rihanna sounds like without autotune, but I never will, basically, between, you know, vocal tracks live and the in-studio kind of pitch fixing.
You worry that it sounds like Linda McCartney in that bootleg track from Wings where it just isolated her vocals and it wasn't very good.
But, exactly.
Rich, stay with us. And Dr. Zeitels, at this point, we're going to let you go and heal the voices of America. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Steven Zeitels is the director of the Voice Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital. This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook.
If I can put you in, let me put you in.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the spate of vocal surgeries for star singers, from Adele to R. Kelly. We're joined this hour by Penelope Bitzes. She's mezzo-soprano and professor of music at Boston University. Also, Rich Juzwiak, pop culture writer for The Daily. We're also taking your calls. On the line is Rory from Montreal, Canada. Rory, go ahead.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
Fascinating. Fascinating. What I was wondering is there maybe a genetic composition of this? Like a guy like Tom Araya from Slayer, a singer like Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead, Ozzy Osbourne, can they just do it no matter how long and how hard and how far?
Well, that's the – and thanks for the call, Rory. Penelope, that's the image they're trying to project, that they're all hell-bent for leather or, you know, on a highway to hell. But is it true? Do those big rock and heavy metal singers have something a genetic difference from some of the frailer pop divas?
Well, I don't know if they're frailer, but, you know, I think it's like Dr. Zeitel once said to me a long time ago that every vocal cord has its own makeup.
Yeah.
And sometimes that makeup makes that voice louder or stronger or – higher or lower, and that makeup is probably part of this component of who can withstand all that extra singing.
Sure, of course. There must be a genetic component to all of this. Now, Rich Jozwiak has been talking about the change in taste, the change in vocal style. So before we rejoin with Rich, what do you think about all of this? Is it your stance that it doesn't matter what the taste is, that the correct form can be taught and a lot of this problem can be avoided? Or do you think it's inevitable if we like the big diva style singers?
I think because of the demands of the schedule,
yes,
along with that, I think sooner or later, a lot of people are going to get into trouble if they're not really, really careful. And I think, you know, like Adele, she's such a great singer and so expressive. But, you know, you can hear where she's getting into trouble. And I'm sure lots of my colleagues who teach could probably give you a litany of a list of things I think she ought to fix to be better vocally.
You can hear a performance even over a television and not in person and say, that way that you're approaching the note is the wrong way, for instance?
Or it's just a little too pressured and it's going to get them into trouble.
You can hear the strain at the end of a note. Is that the big place?
I can hear it in a low, can be in a low ballad. That can even be something like that where you can hear a kind of a low earthiness that's has a different kind of pressure in it than a high, loud, screamy note that eventually wears the chords down a little bit.
Do you think you could diagnose from afar? Do you ever say, if I had a second with her, I'd tell her not only to avoid that, but a different way to produce that?
I wouldn't be that arrogant about
right,
it.
Right,
but,
right.
But I might, you know, I think a lot of voice teachers would say, oh, I think she ought to try this and this and this to try to keep herself in a healthy way. And then there are people who teach a kind of vocal singing that's very vocal function, and they would say they just do these series of exercises, they'll be okay.
Rich Jozwiak, writer for The Daily. We talked before you joined us about Ethel Merman, a hallmark and a style of singing. I think a more recent hallmark, you talk about Whitney Houston, right?
Yes. Whitney is, she was the gold standard, right? It's like Whitney and Aretha, and those are the two best. And Whitney's voice at this point is noticeably diminished. I mean, if she was at 10 before, she's probably at a 2.5.
Mm.
Which is kind of interesting because she's wearing her life on her voice, and her job is to share her soul. At a certain point, you have to pick, I guess, if you're going to be a pop diva or if you're going to be a flawed human being. And Whitney chain-smoking Newports and living life the way that she did, she obviously went that route. It's a little bit disappointing because she was the gold standard. I think someone like Mariah Carey is a lot more interesting because she was just kind of almost a blank workhorse for the first 7 years of her career. And then as her voice deteriorated, she became a lot more of an interesting singer, a lot more nuanced.
Well, let's go back. I want to hear selections from all the women you're talking about. Let's hear Whitney Houston. This is, I think, her biggest song ever, and she's had a lot of them. I Will Always Love You.
I hope life treats you kind, and I hope you have all you dreamed of, and I wish you joy and happiness, but above all this, I wish you love.
Penelope Beatsis, you told me that you are so consumed with listening to classical music, you don't listen to a lot of pop. But when you hear Whitney Houston, is it amazing to your trained ear as it is to my untrained?
Oh, I love this song. And I actually know the song. And I know her singing. She's a great pop singer.
And there's nothing, and this is from 92, but was there anything there that you heard that could Be a problem area?
There's always a little. There's always, I think the nature of pop singing in the Belt has a little bit of pressure in it. So it's always right in there. And that's part of what draws us to it.
Yes. Now, Rich Joswiak, you mentioned that, you know, maybe the fact that Whitney just wears her career on her voice is somehow compelling, although then she was the biggest singer in the world and now she's struggling to get a reality show. I don't know if I agree. I think on someone like Shane McGowan of the Pogues, right? Someone that we never expected to sing well, let alone pronounce the words. With the drunker he gets, perhaps the more poignant it is. But with Whitney, I don't know. I just get more of a sad feeling.
It's definitely sad, but life is sad, and she's sharing her life. You know, it's kind of like a Billie Holiday model in a way. Now, if I'm going to listen to Whitney Houston, yes, I'm going to listen to older Whitney Houston without a doubt. I don't think that her newest album was up to snuff. But at the same time, there's kind of an honesty and there's kind of a fascinating quality to seeing a perfect celebrity brought down to human size.
And that,
yeah.
Keep going.
I think that the soul tradition is to kind of expose your soul, you know, it's right there, you know. So, yes, it's very disappointing to have a goddess become a human being. But at the same time, I think there's worth in that.
You mentioned Aretha and Whitney. You know, Aretha started out so young, just like a lot of the pop singers of today. She still got it, or mostly got it, it seems, it being everything but the sense of what kind of hat to wear to the inauguration. Okay, that's me being catty. But Penelope Beatsis, you know, do you hear let's go back. She started so young. Could that be a problem if singers start too young and put a strain at a young age?
I think now it's probably more of a problem than in the days of Aretha Franklin because of the schedule and what you were talking about, the promotional aspects of getting their materials out there and getting everybody to buy their CDs and go to their concerts. I think all of that creates a lot of wear and tear on those younger singers. And some of them start really young and then we don't hear about them anymore.
Let's go back to Mariah Carey, and that's what, Rich, you were talking about. We have a couple of, I think, good examples, 13 years apart in the career of Mariah Carey. Let's play the songs, Rich, and you tell me what you heard. This is from her 1992 hit, Emotions. That was some sort of sound. Rich, how would you describe the vocalizing we heard there?
I mean, she's just a virtuoso. She opens her mouth and it seems effortless. And it scales, you know, 5 octaves or so. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
A force of nature.
Now, Let's compare it. Let's zoom ahead to a more recent hit. This is from 2005, Shake It Off.
Well, at first I didn't know, but now it's clear to me. You were cheap with all your freaks and like a boss and me. So I packed up my Louis Vuitton, jumped in your ride and took off. You'll never, never find a girl who loves you more than me. I gotta shake it off.
Cause my loving ain't the same, and you keep on playing games like you know I'm here to stay.
I gotta shake it off.
Just like the Calcon commercial light.
Rich Joswiak, aside from song selection and style, what vocal differences are we hearing there?
I mean, that song to me, Shake It Off, sounds lived in. She's interpreting and she's playing a sex kitten and she's doing a bunch of different things with her voice as opposed to just opening it and it coming out. It sounds like she's working to me. And I think that's kind of the exciting thing about Mariah Carey now is that because her voice is diminished, watching her live is like thrilling because it's like, is she going to hit the note? It's like a sports game or something. Interestingly, though, she attributes her nodules on her voice to helping her hit her high notes.
Yes, and when Dr. Zeitels was here, he was talking a little bit about that, how they could use the scars to hit high notes. That was fascinating, too. Let's take a call. Alan's calling from Morrisville, Vermont. Alan, do you want the Whitney Houston backing? Sorry, the Mariah Carey backing track or not for your call? Your choice.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, first I want to say my heart goes out to all the performers who performers, teachers, radio show hosts as well, who have lost their voice in the past. I know for many of them, it's like losing one of your senses. I had experience. I was a elementary music teacher. I lost my voice 14 years ago. It basically changed my life. I had developed vocal nodules, as I told everyone, from misuse, overuse, and abuse. I think the misuse was a big part of it, not really understanding the vocal mechanism. None of us ever grow up with instruction on how to talk, that we, you know, how to form words, yes, but how to phonate, no. And what I did not have any surgery or operation. I went mute for 2 months, and then I did vocal recovery over a year's period in something called resonant kinesiology, where I learned more how the vocal cords work and much more important, how the body serves the purpose of resonating the voice, which was something that, like I say, I don't think anybody ever discussed with me before, even though I had sung a good deal of my life on stage and in classrooms.
What was the single biggest tip or lesson that you took away from that?
Oh my gosh. To focus my voice in the proper place. I think a lot of us work under the myth or the assumption or the wrong assumption that our voice is where our vocal cords are, somewhere in our throat and stuff. And there's not an understanding that our voice is really captured by our whole body. That's only where the sound is sort of made, but the rest of the body serves as the amplifier. And so we get caught in a trap often of forcing our throat to do things that our body would be much better would do a much better job of doing. But few of us know how to do that, and we can all stretch the limits, or many of us can stretch the limits. But obviously, the show is about to what harm?
Yeah.
So I guess that's focusing my voice in the proper spot and really understanding how to relax and move it into. You know, I never knew what a head tone was, even though I used it when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'll just say quickly that growing up in the age of TV and radio, of course, now kids sing all the time, and we grow up singing, and it's not just Facebook and Twitter I guess those aren't actually vocal mediums, are they? But it's not just getting on the phone and the fact that people talk more, but, you know, that at an earlier age we're all exposed to this and we're all encouraged maybe to do it.
Right.
So anyway, I just wanted to shout out to all the other people who weren't so, especially the big performers. I know how much it hurts. And I had a question for your people there.
Yeah.
How common is it in the general population for people to develop nodes and or nodules or have to go through what I went through or else get surgery?
Alan, thank you for the call. Thank you for phonating our way. Penelope Beatsis, do you know? I mean, obviously, you'll see more singers that come in with a problem. But what about just, you know, people who yell their order to sell pork belly futures?
I think there are a lot of people just in daily life who have problems with their voice. I think, in the 30s and 20s, everybody did elocution in school and they learned to support their speaking voice.
Right.
And we don't do that anymore. We're really casual. So I think just even daily users, people use their voices incorrectly. And just talking all day, even if you talk perfectly correctly, your voice is going to be tired if you're teaching all day or using any kind of voice all day long in any kind of ways.
Right, or muttering under your breath in traffic.
That too.
Richard from Milford, New Hampshire. Rich, if you could be quick, I want to take your call. Go ahead, Richard.
Go ahead.
Please. You're on the line. Yes, go.
I'm on the line?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Mike.
Hi.
This is a huge issue. And I'm from New Hampshire, but I spent about 30 or 35 years or so singing in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on, but there's one thing I would like to point out. There's another dimension for cutting through the orchestra, cutting through the sound. It's not just volume, it's timbre, which is the quality of tone. Now, if you stick an S in front of timbre, you get the English word stamp, which is your trademark. So there are two things that you can be heard with, and that what's more important, that people will be listening to you and your unique personality and your voice, which will cut through anything. And the original, and what we have now in the opera is a terrible thing called the squealo, which is a distending of the vocal cords and belting from the diaphragm. And, you know, talk about Johnny Mathis, Tony Bennett. What does Tony Bennett do? He does scales, scales, scales. Like Ingres told to Degas, if you want to succeed as an artist, draw lines. if you want to succeed as a singer, have confidence in your own self, develop your timbre. And that's the gist of it. There are many other technical points that I could bring out.
I like the gist of it. I appreciate you timbring our way. Penelope Beatsis, he alluded to it there. That's the only thing I ever knew about singing, sing from your diaphragm. Is that not right? Do you not always sing from your diaphragm?
Well, the diaphragm drops when you take a breath, and then that breath is what you ride the sound on, and that is a huge thing for singing. And he's right about the timbre. Your distinct timbre is what draws you to a singer, whether a classical singer or a pop singer. Yeah. For classical singers now, the orchestras are so big, and they sing at A440, which is like a really higher pitch. It's much more demanding for them now.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. A great discussion. Penelope Beatsis, Rich Juzwiak, thank you both so much for joining us.
And thanks for having
us. Absolutely. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go out with Shut Up, the new song by R. Kelly about his vocal surgery. I'm Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Every boy, every girl, every child around the world, from the 90s up until the day we'll say all three. Shut up,
shut up,
shut up,
shut up,
shut up,
shut up.
I'm talking to you.
Shut up, oh,
shut up,
shut up, oh,
shut up.
Found my life, oh,
shut up.
Found my life, oh,
I'm talking to you.
If the shoe
fits,
good and weary,
shut up. Shut up, shut up,
shut up,
freedom of speech, I'm talking to you,
thank God for my voice,
shut up.